Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
A new audit looks at how one agency within the Health and Human Services Department manages its cloud computing assets. The HHS Inspector General looked specifically at the Administration for Children and Families. To learn more, Federal News Network's Eric White spoke to the Assistant Inspector General for Cybersecurity and IT Audits, Tamara Lilly.
So each year we look at what work we want to accomplish and we plan it out. In the case of this work, after, you know, lots of headlines, we keep on top of what's going on and when and what is having the greatest impact on the government, in this case, with regards to cybersecurity in a not so positive way, and decided from that to focus a body of work, a series of audits on cloud computing at HHS. And this is just one of several entities within HHS where we'll do this type of assessment.
Gotcha. And yeah, before we get actually into the report itself, since a lot of folks probably aren't aware of it, what is the Administration for Children and Families and what role do they play within HHS?
Well, for HHS, the Administration for Children and Families, their mission is to foster the health and well-being by providing federal leadership and partnership and resources for the compassionate and effective delivery of human services. The program officers are specialized to support a variety of initiatives that are intended to empower families and individuals and improve access to services to create strong and healthy communities.
So in examining them, what kinds of cloud inventories do they actually have and utilize for that mission? And what did you all find when you looked at them?
So ACF uses cloud services, actually uses information systems in general to provide those types of services to the populations and communities they serve. So, for example, probably one of the more well-known programs that ACF runs is the Unaccompanied Children Program. And there are other programs around health and education. So in delivering those services and in accordance with a mandate from the Office of Management and Budget, which was published in 2019, ACF, along with all of government, were required to accelerate their transition or their adoption of cloud-based solutions. And the reason being is these solutions offer agencies the ability to perform their tasks, their missions in a way that is more cost effective because they are able to increase, decrease as their resources dictate.
We're speaking with Tamara Lilly, Assistant Inspector General for Cybersecurity and IT Audits at the Health and Human Services Inspector General. And so how did they do? What did they have in place to safeguard any of that information that is stored on their cloud computing assets?
Overall, we found there are opportunities for them to improve. While some of the security mechanisms that are in place for these cloud information systems were effective in that we had conducted some phishing attacks. Those are the attacks with the emails trying to convince users to click on a link or such in order for an adversary to steal your information. Those types of attacks, we found overall that they prevented our attempt to attack them. And also we found that with some of their systems that are used to interact with the public, that they were able to prevent some of our simulated cyber attacks for those as well. However, we also found that several other security and controls were not as effectively implemented to protect against some other simulated attacks that we performed. Overall, we found that there were 19 security controls in the cloud systems environment that need to be improved in order to comply with federal requirements.
Yes, and you all made a series of recommendations, as the IG usually does. What did those include, and was there any response from the agency, the ACF itself?
Yes, they actually spanned numerous controls. For example, access enforcement, least privilege. So these together are the controls that should be implemented to prevent those that shouldn't have access to the system, don't have that access, that in this case only provides the access that's needed for their employees to do their jobs. So overall, what we found is that those controls, those 19 controls, should be remediated. We also found that, taking a step back, one of the challenges that ACF had was inventorying properly or accurately their cloud information systems. And this is important because knowing what you have in your environment will dictate or assist you in deciding how to protect it and what protections should be in place. So we found that they lacked some policies and procedures around how to accomplish that and to maintain, sustain, and accurate inventory. We also found that they lacked some much needed procedures that would detail for their IT, their information technology, operational staff on how to implement some security baselines or some security mechanisms in those cloud environments such that they comply with HHS as well as overall federal government requirements. And with regards to those simulated attacks that we successfully accomplished, we learned that some of the cloud configurations were weak. And so we recommended that they, again, become familiar with and implement the controls necessary to prevent those types of simulated attacks.
Can we talk a little bit about the stakes here? You mentioned how the agency didn't necessarily have a good grasp of the sorts of data that it had in its inventory. Are we talking about, you know, personally identifiable information for unaccompanied children? Or is there a high risk of somebody actually wanting to get hold of this information from the department?
So just to clarify, it wasn't that we found that the data, specific data, was at risk. What we found is that the controls around protecting that data were not strong or as strengthened as they should be. And then therefore, the potential for exposure of that sensitive information was of concern to us. So in that regard, we overall found that there was an opportunity for ACF to improve and tighten up those to prevent such leakages from happening, in which case would and potentially could have a detrimental effect on those that they service in the communities that they provide assistance to.
Gotcha. Okay. Thanks for the clarification there. And so in your analysis of it, what are the, you know, I'm just curious, is this an exposure that is always there and could always be improved upon just because of the public engagement that this agency in particular has and the levels of, you know, it's just going to be more about having due diligence and making sure the policies are in place? Or is there some way that you can, you know, is cloud computing with a public facing mechanism always going to have these risks associated with them?
I will say, and that's a good question, it is the nuance, if you will, of cloud computing that increases the risk for agencies and for any entity that is sharing responsibility. So the whole model with cloud computing is that some service provider, some other entity, a contractor, provides some part of the system, and that then the entity doing the contracting provides another or other parts of the system or software, and together they work to provide or accomplish a mission or a task or such. And whenever you have more than one, the risk is that, of course, I might do what I'm supposed to do, you may not do what you're supposed to do, or vice versa, or we do a little bit of not enough on both cases. So that's more of a risk in the cloud computing environment. And so in this case, it's important that both parties clearly identify who should be doing and who is responsible for doing what, that they create the policies and procedures around how that should be done, how often it should be done, and also around that who should be doing it. And then one other consideration is that they test and retest to ensure that those mechanisms, those security mechanisms they put in place, will actually protect the systems and the data that those systems contain from adversarial attacks, and ironically also protect against the unintentional mishaps that could be a result of bad weather events or a well-intentioned employee clicking on the wrong thing.
Tamara Lilly, Assistant Inspector General for Cybersecurity and IT Audits for the Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General. Find this interview along with a link to her report at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture. And what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful? So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with an intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth, and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency, and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role, and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah, and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.